Discussion of a humanitarian ceasefire in the Israel-Hamas conflict returns to the United Nations.
The resolution expresses grave concern over the humanitarian situation in Gaza. It demands an immediate humanitarian ceasefire and the immediate and unconditional release of all hostages held by Hamas.
Plus, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky is in Washington.
He, of course, thanked U.S. for current support and for previous support, and that he hopes for the future as well. In addition, President Zelensky confirmed that he already had a meeting with managing director of the IMF.
And later we'll see how Israel's farmers are being impacted by the war. We'll get an update from Kyiv and a look into the climate crisis in Iraq. Today is Tuesday, December 12th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Israeli strikes continued on Tuesday in Gaza, as well as the West Bank town of Jenin. This amid new allegations that Israel used weapons containing white phosphorus, supplied to them by the United States. White phosphorus is sometimes added to ammunition to create tracer rounds, to make smoke, or to light up an area at night. However, it can also cause devastating burns. White phosphorus is not considered a chemical weapon, and its use is generally not prohibited by international treaty, with the exception of using it as an incendiary device on civilians. Mark Miller is a spokesperson for the U.S. State Department. He says the United States is concerned.
We are concerned by the reports of the use of white phosphorus. Obviously, there is a legitimate military use for white phosphorus, but that does not include using them on civilians. It means that if you use them, you have to do everything you can to minimize civilian harm. Anytime that we provide items like white phosphorus or really anything to another military, we do it with the expectation that it will be used for legitimate purposes and in full keeping with international humanitarian law and the law of armed conflict. So we're looking into this and looking for additional information.
President Joe Biden continues to express his wishes that Israel would take more care to avoid civilian casualties in the war and perhaps do things differently.
I make no bones about it. I've had my differences with some Israeli leadership. I've known Bibi for now 51 years. He has a picture on his desk of he and I when he was a young member of the Israeli service here, foreign service. And I was a 32-year-old senator. And I wrote on the top of Bibi, I love you, but I don't agree with the damn thing you had to say. It's about the same today. I love him. But look.
That divide, that split in public opinion between those who are supporting Israel's actions in Gaza and those who do not, was on display last week at the United Nations when the United States vetoed a resolution calling for a humanitarian ceasefire. Later on Tuesday, after this show was recorded, the entire General Assembly takes up the measure. I spoke with VOA's UN correspondent Margaret Bashir.
Well, the UN General Assembly is resuming its emergency special session on Gaza this afternoon, and they're going to consider a resolution, which is basically the same resolution that the United States vetoed in the Security Council. The General Assembly doesn't have the same powers as the Security Council. Security Council resolutions are legally binding under international law. General Assembly resolutions are not. But when they have a huge, overwhelming majority of countries supporting them, they have a moral weight to them. And it's also to make the point that the United States is a bit isolated here now on this subject, because the United States has sided very closely with Israel in the Security Council. Britain has also been very close with Israel. While they didn't use their veto, they did abstain on that resolution on Friday in the Security Council. But today, I expect it will be overwhelmingly adopted, and the resolution expresses grave concern over the humanitarian situation in Gaza. It demands an immediate humanitarian ceasefire and the immediate and unconditional release of all hostages held by Hamas.
So if things are so bad, why did the U.S. veto the resolution in the Security Council? What was their reasoning?
Well, the U.S. says repeatedly that they don't believe it's time for a humanitarian ceasefire. They do support extended humanitarian pauses so that aid could go in, seriously injured people could be evacuated to Egypt. But they agree with Israel's assessment that if you have a humanitarian ceasefire, let's say for a week or more, that could give Hamas a military edge where it could regroup, rearm, resupply, and they don't want that to happen. They really, Israel has declared their main goal of this war is to get out, release all the hostages and end Hamas.
So perhaps some UN mechanics for those of us who may not know. A GA, a General Assembly resolution, cannot be vetoed by a single member like a Security Council resolution can?
Correct. Everybody is equal in the General Assembly. One nation, one vote. In the Security Council, the five permanent members, Britain, China, France, Russia, the United States, they have this veto power that they've had since the end of World War II. And a lot of countries, by the way, want the veto abolished because they do say it clogs up the system and it's preventing the Security Council from doing their mandated job of maintaining international peace and security. We've certainly seen it for the past year and a half on Ukraine with Russia being a veto wielding member in the council.
So looking at later today, if there's nothing the United States can do to stop this vote from happening, and as you say, it's widely expected to be adopted, how is the United States and how are the U.S.'s U.N. representatives preparing to be so isolated, as you say?
Well, I asked the U.S. Deputy Ambassador the other day if they feel that they're becoming more isolated, and he just kind of waved it off and said it's not an issue of isolation. So I'm waiting to see how they react to it this afternoon. In October, when the General Assembly passed their earlier resolution calling for an immediate humanitarian truce, 121 of the 193 countries voted for it. So let's see where the numbers end up today. At that time, there were 7,000 dead Palestinians. Now it's more than double that. So let's see where the I think you'll be able to read the U.S. and Israel's isolation in the numbers. If it's higher than 121, that means a lot of countries are getting frustrated with this war and want to see it end.
Margaret Bashir is VOA's UN correspondent. I reached her in New York. Margaret, thanks for your time this morning. Thanks for your reporting on the subject.
Thanks for having me on.
The splintering of public opinion is on display in Australia, too. There have been large pro-Palestinian demonstrations and rallies by supporters of Israel. Community groups there are reporting a significant increase in Islamophobic and anti-Semitic abuse since the conflict began. From Sydney, Phil Mercer has the story.
Death threats, physical violence, arson and verbal abuse are some of the Islamophobic and anti-Semitic incidents that have been reported in Australia since the start of the war between Israel and the militant group Hamas in Gaza. Data from Islamophobia Register Australia, a community group, indicates that Islamophobic attacks have increased 13-fold since the start of the conflict. The Executive Council of Australian Jewry has told local media that it's seen a 6-fold increase in anti-Semitic incidents in the same period. Pro-Israeli and pro-Palestinian rallies have been regularly held in Australia since the October 7 attacks on Israel by Hamas. A poll published November 29 by Roy Morgan, an independent Melbourne-based research organisation, in conjunction with the Islamic Society of South Australia, found that 49% of Australians believe the Canberra government shouldn't take sides in the current crisis in Israel and Gaza. Of 1,006 respondents aged over 18, 19% said the Australian government should do more to support Palestine, and 17% said it should do more to support Israel. Australian Foreign Affairs Minister Penny Wong is preparing to visit Israel and other Middle Eastern countries in January to help efforts to secure peace. Wong's trip will be the first visit to the region by an Australian federal cabinet minister since the attack by the Hamas militant group on Israel on October 7. A delegation of Australian lawmakers is scheduled to travel to Israel next week to express solidarity with the Israeli people. The Canberra government is committed to a two-state solution in which Israel and a future Palestinian state coexist within internationally recognised borders. Australia has insisted Israel has the right to defend itself against Hamas militants, but has also urged restraint. Phil Mercer, VOA News, Sydney.
Israeli settlers are voicing concern after the United States announced a travel ban on settlers suspected of violence against Palestinians in the West Bank. Reporter Henry Wilkins traveled to the Elkanah settlement in the West Bank and spoke with residents.
Here at the Elkanah settlement, which is home to more than 4,000 Israelis, there is concern that the US may punish people who say they're simply defending themselves. Afik Mansour is a young Israeli resident of Elkanah who says that if a settler hurts an Arab, in most cases there is some reason for it, such as a case where a personal or social harm has happened to him. Mansour says incidents sometimes come out of anger or nerves about situations that have occurred in the past. On December 5th, Secretary of State Antony Blinken announced a travel ban would be placed on Israeli settlers described as extremists who are suspected of committing violence against Palestinians in the West Bank. It's not clear how US authorities will decide who is not eligible for admission. Rights groups say the number of Palestinian fatalities caused by settlers has doubled since Israel's war against Hamas started in October. The United States has been putting pressure on the Israeli government to stop violence by Israeli settlers. The settlement of Elkanah was established in 1977 on land seized from a Palestinian village called Mashar. Today, the settlement has modern apartment blocks, villas, supermarkets, and a strip mall where Israeli settlers go about their daily lives. Israeli settlers are defined as those who have established residences in territories that Israel occupied after the 1967 Six-Day War, including in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. According to the UN, up to 700,000 settlers now live in the West Bank illegally under international law. Palestinians often accuse the settlers of taking land from them by force, and violent clashes between the two sides are frequent. Esti Nadav, an Israeli shopping for Hanukkah festival decorations in Elkanah with her children, says she thinks that at the end of the day, violent people should not be allowed to enter certain places. The question, she asks, is how does one know which settlers are violent? This is very important, she says, because there are people who are innocent and end up being denied entry to the United States. Another settler, who gave her name only as Amelia, said she's not angry about the visa ban. She says Jewish settlers are the victims of slander sometimes. She says the left is looking for a narrative and is trying to slander the people in the settlements. She says she does not understand how the US has decided to ban some Israelis while granting entry to Syrian refugees. According to the UN, 26 Israeli and at least 200 Palestinian fatalities have occurred due to violence in the West Bank this year. Some Israeli settlers are US-born, with dual citizenship, and thus do not require visas to travel to the United States. Henry Wilkins, VOA News, Elkanah, in the West Bank.
The Israeli-Hamas conflict has left death and destruction, but it's also impacting livelihoods and agricultural heartlands. With Israel blocking Palestinian laborers from entering the country since the war began, and foreign workers fleeing Israel, some farmers have had to rely on volunteers to harvest and salvage their crops. Veronica Villafania narrates this report by Alejandro Ernesto in Sora, Israel.
This pomegranate harvest in Israel's kibbutz Sora orchard, about 20 kilometers west of Jerusalem, could have been lost if a group of volunteers hadn't answered a farmer's plea for help. Israel closed its borders following the Hamas October attack, disrupting the supply of Palestinian workers that orchard manager Asaf Tzur relied on to harvest his crops.
We usually work with the Palestinian workers. We work with them for many, many years. And unfortunately, they can't cross the border now. So we're quite helpless. And it was really confusing times.
Fearing the pomegranates would rot, he put out a call for help on social media.
And we just asked the public, we just published it, and we said, well, we have a tremendous problem, we don't know how we're going to pick it, and we're really surprised and really, really excited that so many people all around Israel just came and asked us to help us.
Inbal El-Raz is among the volunteers who turned up to save the crop.
Ando buscando.
I look for places where I can contribute. My friend lives here on the kibbutz, and she told me there is a need for workers. That's what I do now on my days off. I've been to other food, fruit, and vegetable collection centers to save them because they have been left without workers.
In the wake of the October 7th attacks, many foreign workers left the country, and Palestinian laborers are being refused entry, affecting their livelihood. That's something Tsur deeply laments.
We got attacked. You know, we worked with them for many years, and I know their families, and they know mine, and we're friends. Of course, we are in touch.
It's not a long-term solution, but this crop is saved, and Israeli farmers like Tsur are grateful to the many volunteers of all ages who have stepped up to help. For Alejandro Ernesto in Tsura, Israel, Veronica Villafañe, VOA News.
You're listening to Flashpoint, Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. COP28 is winding down in Dubai, but have they reached an agreement on language regarding fossil fuels? We'll hear more in a few minutes. It's a big week for Ukraine on the world stage as it attempts to keep up international support in its fight against the Russian invasion. VOA's Scott Walterman spoke with Anna Chernikova about President Zelensky being in Washington, the EU meeting about Ukrainian membership, and the opening of the Polish border.
Well, you're absolutely right. It's an extremely important week for Ukraine and extremely nervous as well, because, of course, the aid, U.S. aid, remains in doubt, as well as negotiations with the EU are quite complicated due to Hungarian position in this. So definitely Ukrainians worry, Ukrainians hope that this week will be successful. And of course, President Zelensky is in the U.S. personally. On Tuesday, he is to meet with President Biden, but he already had meetings with the Defense Minister Lloyd Austin. He said that basically what was discussed is that the future support and future defense strategy was discussed with the Minister of Defense of the U.S. Also, President Zelensky confirmed that he, of course, thanked U.S. for current support and for previous support, and that he hopes for the future as well. In addition, President Zelensky confirmed that he already had a meeting with managing director of the IMF, and that additional support will be allocated to Ukraine.
Not only did they re-up their commitment, but president of the IMF also urged all Ukrainian donors to step up and continue to contribute.
Yes, exactly. And this is extremely important that this is, this is announced, and this is what Ukrainians as well here inside of the country are hearing. For Ukrainians, for the society, it's important to have this in the spotlight.
And they did get more money also this week from the EU.
EU is another important foreign page for Ukraine for this week because, of course, the most important, and this is what Ukrainians are expecting, is the beginning of accession negotiations, as well as the confirmation of the new package of aid. And here, what's important to understand is that Hungary, is currently blocking these decisions, both of those. And we can see that Minister of Foreign Affairs, as well as Minister of Defense of Ukraine, had negotiations with their counterparts from Hungary, as well as President Zelensky had a brief meeting with Prime Minister Orban.
Also, you had good news about the border with Poland opened.
At this point, our situation is looking more positive than it was days ago, and particularly, of course, good news for Ukraine. Yesterday, a new prime minister was appointed in Poland, Donald Tusk, who is known for his good friendship with the Ukrainian government, and also his latest announcements were quite positive for Ukraine, so there is a big hope that this issue would be resolved quite soon.
That's VOA's Scott Walterman speaking with Anna Chernikova in Kyiv. Changing gears now to the climate crisis, there is a standoff at the climate summit in Dubai between countries that want a dramatic phase-out of fossil fuels that cause global warming and countries that don't. AP correspondent Donna Warder reports.
Countries are still far apart on key issues, including an agreement on what to do about fossil fuels that are causing global warming. The United Nations-led summit was scheduled to end around midday today, but Monday's release of a draft agreement angered countries that insist on a commitment for rapid phase-out of coal, oil, and gas. Dan Jørgensen is Denmark's global climate policy minister.
It's very, very clear there's no support for this text. So we need more ambition. We need more ambition on the phase out of fossils.
A new draft agreement is promised to come out today, but a senior negotiator for a developing nation who doesn't want to be named says that fossil fuel phase out language is not in the new draft. I'm Donna Warder.
And finally today, a look at how the climate crisis is hitting home in Iraq. As officials in Dubai enter the final hours of the International Climate Conference, families in Iraq, one of the world's most impacted countries, are being forced to abandon their family farms as villages get swallowed by desert. VOA's Heather Murdoch reports with Halani Koy.
Iraq's countryside has long suffered from climate change, with regional temperatures rising roughly 1.5 degrees Celsius since the 1990s, according to the International Committee of the Red Cross. The rise has made the country unlivable in many places. This well used to supply water for several villages. Now it is dried up, like the nearby river. Many crops cannot grow, and even farm animals do not have enough to eat. This is Mahmoud Hawassan Mohammed, an Iraqi farmer. He says the loss of the well water affected him in every way. He says the whole area was affected, even the livestock, and people sold their animals. He says he doesn't know how to fight back. The whole area, he says, has become dry. Mohammed says it has been 7 years since he was able to profit from farming, and many people in this region have abandoned their land and moved to the nearest city, Mosul. There they find not enough low-paying jobs in the beleaguered city, still not fully recovered from war, 6 years after it ended. And aid workers say life is even harder for people in southern Iraq, where rising temperatures and the increasing frequency of desert sandstorms have driven thousands of people from their homes in recent years. Sadiq Mahdi of the social care organization in Iraq says that as rain has decreased, temperatures have risen, sandstorms have increased, and the trees have become sparse. And all of this has affected the agricultural sector. Many years of international efforts have done little, if anything, to stop the rising temperatures in Iraq, he says. But Mohammed, the farmer, says he won't move yet, even as some neighbors are giving up on farming. He and others planted 60 to 70 tons of wheat, but he says there was no rain last year and none this year. He says his children are looking elsewhere to make a living, as they see no future here. But options are limited, he says, after decades of war and humanitarian crisis. The flight of agricultural workers into the cities is driving those cities deeper into poverty, which is already crippling the country. Heather Murdoch with Halan Akoy, VOA News in Najmuk Village in Iraq.
And that's going to wrap up today's show. There is more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
Stay up to date with VOA Podcasts. Each weekday, International Edition covers the world's biggest stories, while Flashpoint Iran and Flashpoint Ukraine examine their respective regions in depth every week.